and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the Markets team.
This week on the show, it really was a week of curveballs. We saw a record one-day surge in oil prices. That was followed by an unexpected jump in short-term financing costs. And that all before the much-awaited Federal Reserve meeting.
And if all of that wasn't crazy enough, of course, we will end the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sarah, I assume you are prepared with a crazy item.
I'm very prepared with a crazy item. And we do have a call-in this week. So remember, going forwards, we do have our very own Bloomberg podcast hotline. You have any questions for us, you have your very own crazy things you want to share, go ahead, give us a call, leave us a message. It's 646-324-3490.
And Sarah, joining us this week is a woman. She has a list of accolades and resume items about a mile long. I'll just give you a few of them here, though. She was named one of the 25 most powerful women in finance by American Banker. In 2005, she actually was appointed to and served on the president's advisory panel on federal tax reform. But here's a trivia question for you, Sarah.
All right, I'll
our
take
guest,
it.
What does this guest, myself, and Joe Biden have in common?
I'm blanking. I don't know. Give us the answer.
She didn't do her homework.
I didn't.
We all attended the finest university.
I was going to say school, but I felt like that was too easy of an answer.
Anyway, welcome to the show. Lizanne Saunders. She's the chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab.
And a blue hen.
That's what
proud.
Matters. So the first question, obviously, is Deer Park Tavern or Stone Balloon?
Stone Balloon.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I have a strategy for getting free beers at the Stone Balloon. And as a strategist, you'll appreciate this. But we'll save that for later in the show. But also joining us this week, I think this week she was the hardest working reporter in Bloomberg because she covers the repo market and short-term interest rates, which became the story of the week. So she's here to tell us all about it. Alex Harris, welcome to the show.
Ah, thanks for having me.
She is not a blue hen. I forget where you went to college.
I'm a terrier. I went to Boston University.
Okay.
Well, I'll have to take a field trip. I'll show us your alma mater.
And your drinking spots.
Yeah. So Lizanne, let's start with you. Obviously, the buzz in the stock market lately has been on this rotation, a factor rotation out of momentum, out of growth into sort of value stocks. To me, though, you know, I think back to the old days before the sort of the factor language took over our vocabulary. And if I was looking at this market, I would think, well, isn't it just a rotation out of defensives back into cyclicals and maybe back the other way now? How do you view it? What exactly was it that we just witnessed over the last couple of weeks? And, you know, am I right to think that this is as much a defensive to cyclical rotation as it is some sort of factor thing?
I think you're right. And it's an important point because oftentimes when the term or factor of momentum is used, people think of it as sort of the high growth cyclical stocks. Momentum can be in anything. You can have momentum in small cap stocks or momentum in large cap stocks or value or growth or cyclicals or defensive. It really just means the stocks that are doing well are the stocks that have been doing well. Where you find that momentum can vary. And I think you're right. I think that the shift that occurred was largely a function of perceptions about the economy, that maybe we were seeing sufficient green shoots. We had seen a pickup in the Citi Economic Surprise Index. We had seen some better than expected economic numbers. And I think the shift occurred in terms of where investors were focusing. And that was the move more toward cyclicals. And then because valuations had got stretched, I think there, for whatever reason, it kind of triggered a value mindset, at least for a week or so. I'm not sure that this rotation is going to persist, but that's what happened in the last week or two.
It seems we have a debate across Wall Street. You have some firms saying this is going to continue. You have some saying absolutely not. This was just a blip and we are going to see a reversion, as we kind of did see this past week. How difficult is it to make a call like that at this point in time? Because you have so many factors out there, like trade, for example, that could really change on a dime.
We've actually been saying to our investors that this is a pretty treacherous environment to try to trade around, whether it's sectors or factors, because it can turn on a dime. And the market, to some degree, has become more of a reaction function than a leading indicator. It's reacting to every tweet on trade or these adjustments in factors, and you've got the algos and the quants keying off slight shifts in the market. And I think an environment for individual investors that is very difficult means, if anything, you don't want to shorten your time horizon to play in that game, but if anything, lengthen the time horizon, because ultimately there's still going to be a connection between actual fundamentals and prices. So that's been our message.
Listen, I wanted to read a passage from one of your recent notes. You write, "I've been using the tail end of a Shakespeare quote to characterize the U.S. stock market's behavior over the past 20 months or so." Quote, "Full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." I'll confess, I didn't do really well in Shakespeare in college.
Neither did I. That's
one of
the few that I remember.
Right. The Grateful Dead was in town the night before my final, so I do have a valid excuse.
Very valid.
But you go on to say that we've been recommending investors consider rebalancing more frequently as the market swings provide favorable opportunities. I'm curious if you could unpack that for us a little bit, you know, sort of what type of allocations you're talking about, how frequently should the rebalancing occur?
So the answer to the last part of your question, there's no one precise answer to that. It really depends on whether the investor is in a taxable account, a non-taxable account, what their income needs are, what past experience is, all of those factors. And to the part of the question before that, around the actual allocation that you're rebalancing around, that's the strategic allocation. And we have models that span from the most aggressive end of the spectrum to the most conservative end of the spectrum. And so that's the first step investors have to take, is coming up with a plan, figuring out who you are as an investor. One of the mistakes that investors make is they too often automatically tie time horizon to risk tolerance. They think, okay, I'm young, I've got 40 more years, therefore I'm a risk tolerant investor. But if you're going to freak out at the first 5% drop in your portfolio, I don't care how young you are not a risk tolerant investor. I've known older investors who are perfectly willing to take the risk, and therefore they're risk tolerant. So the last 20 months has been interesting. And the reason for using that quote, of course, is because from the January 26, 2018 peak to basically where we are now, we're only up a few percentage points in the S&P, but we've seen a lot of movement around that. You saw the shortfall implosion, 10% correction in the early part of 2018. You saw the near bear market in the latter part of 2018. You've seen, obviously, the rally after that into the highs in April, and then a sell-off, the highs in July, and then a tough August. So you're getting more frequent opportunities to rebalance. It's generally a boring thing to talk about in the media. That's why I love a longer form like this. Rebalancing does two things. It forces us to do what we know we're supposed to do, which is buy low, sell high, or add low, trim high. And your portfolio tells you when it's time to do something. You don't have to worry about making a market call or you know, which Yahoo on a Bloomberg podcast is going to have the right short-term market call. Your portfolio is going to say, you know what, your equity allocation is now 8 percentage points above where it was when you established the plan. Maybe you should pare it back. And it just kind of keeps investors, to use trader lingo, on the right side of the trade. And that's the closest thing you get to a free lunch.
We need more Yahoos on the podcast.
Absolutely. Right. You don't classify as one, obviously.
But that's sort of, to my ears, this sort of fits in with another thing that you've said, is that we're late cycle. And that, I mean, that's kind of the market behavior you should expect late into a cycle, right? A lot of sort of volatility and not necessarily a clear indication that more records are ahead.
And I'm not here to definitively say we've seen a market top by any means, but eventually at the end of a cycle, you top on the market, you have your next bear market. We didn't quite get there by, you know, a fractional amount in the fourth quarter of last year. But tops, to the extent we're in one, they are historically processes over time. Bottoms tend to be more V-shaped, where tops tend to be processed over time. You have to look for things like non-confirmation. One of the things I talked about in that report from which you pulled my Shakespeare quote was the non-confirmation, the fact that notwithstanding the recent relative pop by small caps, you haven't seen that confirmation by small caps. The Russell 2000 has been making a series of lower highs. You haven't seen the confirmation by indexes like the Value Line Arithmetic Index, which is an equally weighted index. So those are the kinds of things that tend to unfold when you're at the end of the cycle, not to mention what we're seeing in the economic data, but the relation that that has to the stock market.
Let's bring in the conversation on oil, because earlier in the week, we did see a huge spike in oil prices after that drone strike on Saudi facilities. And immediately you had your doomsayers coming out of the woods and saying, oh my gosh, we're seeing a spike in oil. This is what typically happens before a recession. Since we have seen prices calm down a bit, what's your take? Is this really something to be worried about yet or no?
We don't know yet. First of all, the things like this, whether it's sort of a black swan military type thing, they don't tend to be long lasting in terms of impact on the economy or market unless they turn into a protracted military conflict and or the spike persists long enough that it becomes an economic problem. It is true that most recessions have had a spike in oil prices leading into them, including the last three. 91, 01, 2007 had between 160% and 260% spike in crude oil prices heading into them. Of course, there were myriad other reasons why we had those recessions, not least being what was going on in 2007. So no one looks back at the 07 to 09 recession and says it was purely oil, but it was a factor. The difference, though, when comparing today to past experiences is that the structure of the U.S. economy around the energy industry and the impact of oil prices, as we are now a net producer, we're the largest producer, we have a larger employee base and a larger portion of our economy in the industrial sector on the CapEx side that benefits from higher oil prices. And that's why when we have seen spikes in the past several years in oil prices, although it hurt the energy sector in earnings, that's the proximate reason why we got the 2015-2016 mm-hmm. earnings recession, it didn't take the entire U.S. economy down with it. And so I think we have to understand that there are offsets right now that are very different than if we were analyzing a spike in oil prices back in the 70s.
Listen, I also want to get your take on the craziness in the repo market, but let's bring Alex in here to just explain all what happened. Now, Alex, I'm going to give the four dummies explanation of the repo market.
Turn it into English.
Four dummies by dummies, right? The best one I saw, someone on Twitter said it's like payday loans for banks. But so basically, a bank sells treasuries to a counterparty under the assumption that they will buy them back at a future date at a slightly higher price. And in return, they get a bunch of short-term financing. I mean, that's in a nutshell.
Yeah, usually we just call it an overnight loan collateralized by treasuries. But yeah, we could go with your explanation, too.
payday loans for banks. So explain to us where the wheels came off the bus this week.
Okay, well, in theory, this is kind of where it all started. A lot of things that happen in the repo market are all about supply and demand mismatches. So what we were starting to see is you had all this treasury supply that the government had sold. It was settling, and that was going on to the dealer balance sheets and into the market. And at the same time, you were getting this wave of collateral, you were getting a lot of pullback of cash from money markets, from banks. And these are the people who were holding this cash were corporations. These are people who had corporate taxes to pay on September 16th. So we already knew there was going to be some pressure there. But there's really what people are looking for now is sort of this persistent unknown. It was someone or something in the market that sort of jolted it. There had been rumors about Saudi Arabia either pulling cash out of the market or people stopped lending to Saudi Arabia because of concerns as to what happened over the mm-hmm. weekend. You know,
right, I was going to ask, how satisfied are you with the explanation?
Not at all.
That it was all tax bills coming due.
It is a little too easy, but it is a big deal because I think it, you know, what we had seen and the volatility, I think, underscores a couple of very important points here. And one is there's just way too much treasury debt. We are issuing way too much as a sovereign, and it's becoming problematic because you're not getting people increasing the amount that they're taking. You know, those indirect bidders you talk about that come into the auctions, right. They have not been increasing the amount that they're taking down. They've stayed constant even as supply has risen. And so the dealers are getting saddled with more of this, and it's choking them a little bit, and it's making the balance sheets harder to manage. And so this is where some of that pressure is coming. It's too much collateral, and we have to eat it, and it's only going to get worse. So this is one of the big problems. And then the second is just that, you know, it's part of it's the Fed and just mismanagement of reserves and understanding where reserve scarcity is. And this is one of the things that Jerome Powell brought up in his press conference.
What's to be said about the argument that this is a long-term issue, that you've had these regulations in place, you've seen the reserves come down, and now we don't have enough liquidity in times of stress?
It is. It is a problem. You know, the way when I remember watching all these regulations go into effect, things like it's the alphabet soup. You have liquidity coverage ratio. You had the net, you have the net stable funding ratio. You have the supplementary leverage ratio. And I kind of was looking at this and felt like they were doing the same thing with the same pile of money. And I was like, well, this just seems like you're just tying up the same money in knots. And so I was worried about this even a few years ago, and even when they had been discussing these and they were rolling out these Basel reforms, and kind of said, this might be a problem. And now I think this is what you're seeing, is that there are some very serious structural issues. And I'm not just talking about with regulations, but just in general with the state of the Treasury market, you know, Fed and reserves and the balance sheet that, you know, need to be fixed. And there's no quick fix. And the Fed actually just came out and said Friday morning they're doing a fourth operation this week. It's what they call a system repurchase agreement operation, wherein the up to $75 billion, the banks can offer up to $75 billion of securities, and that's how much the Fed will take. And it's a liquidity injection, so you'll get some liquidity and cash into the market. So the problem is that we don't know how long they're going to be doing these. And this is really what I'd like to think is a Band-Aid covering a bullet hole. It's not a long-term fix here. And, you know, the Treasury bill auctions were very interesting on Thursday because they were awful. And what someone had said to me was, this is a set of investors that don't believe that the situation in the repo market and the volatility that we've seen is over. You know, you have quarter end in 11 days. You have a series of issues on the forefront going into fourth quarter, including more Treasury bill supply, you know, more liability issues with the Fed's balance sheet. You have regulatory constraints at the end of the year. Like, this is far from over. And the market believes that there's another pressure point coming, and they're just not sure when, but they know it's coming.
Lizanne, if I'm a client of Schwab and I'm saving for retirement or whatever, how much do I need to pay attention to this? And mainly I'm wondering because finally this year we've seen money market funds put off a yield that's somewhat attractive, over 2%. It sounds from everything Alex is telling us, we can sort of count on those cash yields staying pretty high if you consider 2% high. As a sort of average Joe retirement saver, do I need to worry about this stuff?
And, you know, at this stage, I never set my default switch to nothing to see here, no big deal. I think we're in the early stages of understanding that there is a kink in the plumbing of the system here. You could take the side that goes back sort of pre-07 to the inception of the Fed, you know, 90 years prior. And they used to quite frequently make adjustments to their balance sheet to counteract supply and demand associated with their liabilities. And it was a normal course of operations. But in the post-07 environment, with the advent of three rounds of quantitative easing and all this other unprecedented monetary policy, I think that's what ignited some of the fears. You know, is this another form of QE? Is this another liquidity squeeze that is signaling something much more dramatic? I think it's a little bit too soon to tell. We're not in a position to think that this is some sign of impending doom here. But, you know, Alex brings up a good point. The number one topic of questions that I get from our investors out on the road is about the implications of our trillion-dollar deficit and the high and ever-rising burden of debt. We know that now it's the case that politicians on neither side of the aisle care a lick about this anymore, but investors do. And I think what the investors that I talk to, they're trying to quantify. I know I'm worried about this. I know I should be worried about this. And it's not just what are the implications for my grandkids, but is there going to be some shoe to drop? Is there going to be some crisis associated with now trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see? And of course, a cumulative effect of running deficits, which is debt. And if we start to see that demand for treasuries is waning in an environment where more treasury issuance has to be out there in order to fund the deficit, I get a little bit of a sour feeling in my stomach.
Now, the cool kids out there will reply, well, we have modern monetary theory now. None of
magic
this
money tree.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one.
I read that. That might have been bank credit analyst.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting. If you think about Donald Trump's tweets in this context where he sits there and goes, well, we need QE. Europe's doing it. The BOJ has got their program. If you think about it in that context, what he's saying actually makes sense. Because if you have the Fed now coming in and buying more of these treasuries, and which people think they're going to start doing again, that is like a light form of MMT. And so then it just gives them room to keep issuing right. debt without any consequence. And as we all know, President loves his debt. Like right. he's never met a debt deal that he hasn't liked.
And are they really overnight loans when you can roll them over every day?
Right. Yeah.
Before we get to the craziest thing, you said that the question that you are constantly asked is about the deficit. So I have to ask you then, what's your guy's answer to them?
Well, the different forms of the question. So when sometimes I get a question from somebody that might be a sympathizer to the bipartisan view that it doesn't matter, and they'll say, but we haven't had to suffer the consequences of it. I say, well, I beg to differ. First of all, the total credit market debt is the broadest measure of debt. It's inclusive of federal, state, and local debt, but also all household debt, corporate debt, and financial sector debt. You add that all up, it's 350% of GDP. So thinking debt in that holistic way, to suggest that we haven't had to face the consequences, I'd love to know what lovely rock you were living under in 08, because that was a massive bursting of a debt bubble that took the entire global financial system down with it. That unleashed massive household sector deleveraging. It unleashed massive financial sector deleveraging. But of course, government debt continued to ramp up. And then now corporate debt has ramped up as well. Back to the specific federal government debt and implications. You know, the MMTers think that, we are the global monetary standard. We can print our own currency. Therefore, we don't have to worry about this. I say that the implication of this high and rising burden of debt is not necessarily prospectively, but one, an environment we're already living in. This is the longest economic expansion in history. It's also the weakest by far. And I think this high and ever rising burden of debt, the crowding out effect, the fact that so much money has to go and will continue to have to go to servicing the debt, it crowds out investment in more productive uses. So we're living with the consequences. This is not some future moment in time. So I think the crisis in terms of federal government debt is a subtler one that persists over time. With Japan as a perfect example of that. They've been in a, three-decade economic malaise because of this burden of debt.
Right. And nowhere is it written in stone that the dollar is the global reserve currency forever, too.
So. I think it will be in my lifetime, which is far from forever. But but I do think we will get to a point where there might be multiple reserve currencies, even if the U.S. dollar maintains its place as the global monetary standard.
Right. One last question before we get to the crazy things, too. And I will give you my stone balloon free beer strategy, too. I noticed you're bullish on healthcare. I've heard a few people say this. Is this mainly a demographics thing, a defensive thing?
We have, there's 11 sectors, and we publish tactical ratings on sectors. We're pretty neutral right now. We only have one outperform, and that's healthcare, because we think it offers what you want right now. It's kind of a blend of growth, but at a reasonable price.
Right.
Valuation reasonable because of some of the political concerns mm-hmm. that have kept it from kind of running away. So we just think it's the one area where you get that nice mix of growth and value. With the exception of communication services, which is an underperform, everything else is neutral. Going back to what we started talking about initially, it's just a tough environment to have kind of a consistent sector call. Sectors have been all over the map in the last year. And in that kind of environment, we just kind of want to hug around neutral.
All right. And the strategy to get a free beer at the Stone Balloon, Sarah, this was kind of a rowdy bar.
We've been waiting all show for
back
this.
Today. And one of the most favorite pastimes of at least the men who went to this bar was getting in fist fights with each other. So there'd be this fight, and they had these huge burly bouncers who would go and drag the guys out of there. And one time they were dragging a guy out, and the bouncer knocked my beer out of my hand. So I went up to the bartender. I said, your bouncer knocked my beer out of my hand. Can I get? And he's like, oh yeah, no problem. He gave me a refill. So every time there was a fight, then I would finish off my beer.
Mike's condoning lying. Yes. That's what he's doing right now.
But this is for the college kids out there. The statute of limitations, I think, is over on
this. It's worth it. It's worth it. All right. With that said, though, I think it's that time.
It's the time for the craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week. I believe we got a call into the What Goes Up hotline, which is very exciting. Sarah, what does the voicemail say?
We did. So we got it from Ben Emmons. He's been on the show before of Medley Global Advisors, and he was talking about Draghi and the ECB last week, saying he couldn't believe that they went ahead with quantitative easing, even though there was just so much dissent on the governing council. Listen in.
Which means that there's going to be a political revolution within the ECB, and that will be really the craziest thing we will see, meaning there's going to be significant outflow from bonds in Europe into other markets. And I think this is the craziest, if not the most significant development we had last week.
Outflows from European bonds. That would be crazy, Sarah.
It would be crazy seeing yields go back into positive territory.
In our lifetime?
Yeah, in our lifetime. It'll happen. And remember, it was Draghi's last meeting as well. So we'll see what happens under Lagarde.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben Emmons, for that voicemail. Sarah, can you top that?
All right, I'll go first, and I'll keep it short. I'll keep it as short as possible. So if you're paying attention to Overstock at all, the stock has had a pretty wild ride, and it's just an absolute crazy story. So when Patrick Byrne, the ex-CEO, is in place, they put in place this digital dividend that has this blockchain link. And what happened was there are people who were short selling the stock, and they knew that they weren't going to be able to get this digital dividend that was going to be set out. So they all had to close their short positions. So you had this crazy rally to the tune of almost 80% in Overstock. Then there was a lot of confusion between the broker dealers and the regulators. So Overstock came out and said that no, they are going to register this digital dividend with regulatory authorities. You basically had the stock completely come back down, reverse all of it. And then after all that happened, ex-CEO Patrick Byrne posted on his blog that he was selling all of his Overstock shares, and he's putting it in gold, silver, and two cryptocurrencies because he sees where the economy is going and it's not good. So pretty crazy.
That guy has a habit of making his way into our craziest things of the week. Lizanne, did they warn you about our gimmick here?
Our tradition? Yes, they did. So mine, maybe because I had my 55th birthday earlier this week.
Oh,
so
happy birthday.
I'm already feeling old. And I was having a conversation two nights ago with a group of investors, some of whom were on the younger end of the spectrum. And we were talking about the Fed. And I made the comment about don't fight the Fed. And this young gentleman said, oh, I've heard that line. I said, actually, that phrase was coined by my first boss and mentor in the business, Marty Zweig, for whom I worked from 1986 to 1999. Mm-hmm. And so he had never heard of Marty. And in addition to don't fight the Fed, the trend is your friend was often credited to Marty. And then don't fight the tape. So I mentioned don't fight the tape. And he said, what's the tape?
Oh, gosh.
So I explained it. Well, it's in reference to the ticker tape. And he had the follow up. What's the ticker tape?
And then,
as we were talking earlier, you know, I come down the circular escalator to come to Bloomberg, and there's this little museum gallery of all the Bloomberg terminals, and they go from left to right, old to new. And I don't go all the way to the far left one, but the second to left one.
Reminiscing is a good birthday present.
From the mid-1980s. I think I was vintage 1987 in my first Bloomberg terminal.
Vintage.
Yes, vintage.
That was the peak Bloomberg. And that is why Lizanne is on the Wall of Fame at the University of Delaware. I think my name's on the bathroom at the Stone Bowl.
Yeah, did you put it
there? Mine might still be there too.
Alex, was there anything crazier than the repo madness this week?
No, this was it. And I mean, even people who have been in this market for decades were calling each other and like, this is crazy. Every repo desk I talked to was just like, this is crazy.
That was the lead of one of your stories,
yeah.
Wasn't it? This is crazy.
This is crazy. Because it was. And that was the thing, because you couldn't necessarily see it. And that most of the community said, yes, we know these are the issues, and that unknown was lingering, and it's still lingering, and I think it's making people very weary going forward as to what this is going to be like for the rest of the year.
Let me ask you, if this Fed hadn't stepped in when they did, and this had gone on for, say, the rest of the week, would we have started to see some firms blow up, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And this is the problem, is that what I was hearing is that the Fed actually came in too late in this set of operations, that they had needed to come in sooner. I think you saw, the Tuesday operation was way too late in terms of timing because most of the financing is done very early in the morning. So 10 o'clock, it was pretty much done, which is why you didn't see the full $75 billion hit the way you saw it Wednesday and Thursday. And then, you know, the other thing is, too, there are factors that were showing that repo was starting to normalize a bit. And one of the things is every month you have the government-sponsored entities collect mortgage payments from homeowners. And there is a lag between what they collect and then what goes out to the bondholders. And that gets put into the repo market. So you do get a cash influx and that helps bring repo rates down. So it's hard to say as to whether or not the Fed's really having an effect here or it's just this influx of cash that we're seeing in the market right now. You know, we'll see next week. We'll see quarter end. If they can actually be proactive and prevent something, maybe I'll feel better about the Fed and their role in this. But it's really too hard to say whether it was them or it was this influx of cash that was also coming in.
All right, my craziest thing, I'll make it quick. Morgan Stanley has developed artificial intelligence robot, we'll call it, that reads muni bond prospectuses. For all the people that complain about robots taking their job, I'm not sure anyone's going to complain about not having to read muni bond prospectuses. But a couple quick things that it's discovered. The more words, the better. They figured out that documents that have at least 20,000 words longer than average, I believe it's average, tend to default less. So longer is better. But here's my favorite. Speculative developments tend to rely on the word Mr. to highlight the management of the project, since the riskier deals need to play up their executive skills. So the more they say Mr., watch out. And that's a great story by our own Amanda Albright.
All right, check that out. But we've got to say, crazy things really span the gamut this week. There are so many options. But Alex Harris, Lizanne Saunders, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. Our guest Liz Ann Saunders is at Liz Ann Saunders. And Alex Harris is Who's Alex Harris? You can also follow Bloomberg Podcast at Podcast. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.